behalf of the Gaboni to the AD of Atacama, it was a natural thing to try to see if I could push it and push it back to the inflationary area. Now, as you know, there are 100 orders of magnitude between the vacuum energy then and the vacuum energy now. So pushing it back is an untrivial exercise. While I want to report on these efforts, I cannot say that I can explain anything, but it's an effort to rationalize. And in order to do so, I have gone through a whole gambit of conceptual problems that we have to confront when we're dealing with gravity and quantum field theory together. And I'll touch upon various elements of this gambit of questions that present themselves. So in order to do so, I decided now to try to go back all the way where our fathers conceived that the universe grew out of a primeval chaos. One contemplates meant to take a picture from Mukhanov's book to show you how Mukhanov translates sentence one. So from this chaos, somehow, in some manifold, some stuff, which is chaotic in character, forms a more homogeneous mass than the rest. Being somewhat more homogeneous than the rest, somehow you contemplate that macroscopic, and when I use the word macroscopic, I mean cis-Planckian as against trans-Planckian, that macroscopic physics supplies a guide to handle this initial homogeneous bunch of stuff that's singled out of this mess of unknown character in this manifold of unknown character. You rely on elements that we know about quantum field theory as a guide. You look at, for example, the inflaton scenario. Inflation is then an attractive solution that enhances this homogeneity, an attractive solution that enhances the homogeneity because of the rapid expansion, so that the inhomogeneities which are left in this roughly homogeneous but smooth out very rapidly, and you create a universe. This universe is supposed to be described by conventional quantum fields which ride upon this mess. And in addition to the quantum fields which ride upon this mess, there's a concept of a condensed medium, a classical condensed field, some composed of something or other that's composed out of this mess to make it homogeneous. This carries systematic energy density then and small fluctuations. And the physics that we use begins there. So from there to there, it's biblical and theological, and then it starts to acquire a little rationality in our minds from that point on. I like the way Mukhanov drew it.
Face the book upwards.
Show me how
that works. Like you're reading it. Voila. Like you're reading.
Okay.
Just the page. Just the page where I'm
talking. Just one page. Which page do you want to show?
I didn't take telescopes along. Okay, doesn't matter. Here, look. That's the mess.
I can't see that from.
I asked if this could be done by the organizers. I said, sure. And I'll have another one to do after that, in the middle of my talk.
It's coming, warming up. It's almost there.
Okay, I like this picture very much. Okay, okay. So this is the undefined mess. And then very early times, there's some kind of little homogeneity works out into the mess, where classical concepts and assist Blankian concepts begin to be valid in this little homogeneous thing. And as I say, it's an attractive solution. That's beautiful. When you use the physics, assist Blankian physics that we know, classical physics and assist Blankian quantum field theory, then that thing grows, becomes more homogeneous, and see the universe. That's the way I conceive of the start of things. Be it right or wrong, I have to have something to hang on to. Now, a very early effort in this direction was proposed by François Englert and myself in 1977, in which we tried for a self-consistent solution in which there was initially this mess, which was likened to flat, empty vacuum. And then it was tested. A little space-time curvature was put onto it. Space-time curvature induced the creation of energy momentum of quantum fields. The energy momentum of quantum fields produced more space-time curvature from that reaction. There was a self-consistent solution. We worked it out. We got an inflating universe. And we said, OK, we're happy we have at least some excuse for a causal universe to arise. And then we promptly dismissed it, because in order to realize this scenario, we had to appeal to transplantian physics, and we used physical concepts where the physical concepts that we used were not applicable. So that was the end of that. And I've had many other faults I won't go into. Then, some years later, something much more satisfactory happened. A little matter at this point, that we don't know what the inflaton field means. We don't know its mechanisms of condensation, but it works. It works. For the same reason that the first scenario worked, in that it explained causality, it explained flatness, but it works so much better for two reasons, namely because it supplies a backbone about which to study field fluctuations, and therefore give a quantitative account of cosmic-ray background fluctuations, which is wonderful, in a very quantitative way. And it works beautifully because it supplies very automatically a graceful exit to inflation. Other things we understand less well. We don't understand why it condenses. We don't understand precisely what the turnover is from inflation to adiabaticity, called reheating. That's a folkloric word. But we have mechanisms that will cause that classical condensate to disaggregate and become quanta, but we're not at all sure really of what the mechanisms are, as far as I know. When inflation dies, there is a systematic of classical energy, that systematic of condensation energy, it's converted to excitations, which are the you and me. That's our world. So, this is just a brief resume of the kind of problems we're confronted with. So, this classical condensation energy goes over in reheating to radiation and mass quanta. In addition to that, it leaves behind a vacuum energy called dark energy, which I presume in this talk is a vacuum energy, and many other people also presume this. This vacuum energy is 10 to the minus 100 of the vacuum energy, of the order of, when I say order, the order of magnitudes are not in yes dimensions, of the vacuum energy we contemplate during inflation. This vacuum energy, this number, is what was the object of the study of this paper, Ahmed, Green, Dobelson, and Sorkin, called Everlasting Lambda. I'm going to interpret this paper, and I'm going to come up with the words, I am coming up with the words, this dark energy that they come by can be interpreted as a fluctuating remnant of inflation. And because it is the fluctuating remnant of inflation, in my opinion, I am tempted to take it back to inflation. And there is a parameter in their scenario, which I'm going to interpret as a mass parameter. And because I'm taking their scenario back to inflation, I'm going to interpret that mass scenario, that mass, which appears in their dark energy scenario, as a candidate for the inflaton mass, once I make a model from these considerations of what the inflaton field might be. And every sentence I say must be put in the conditional sense. Might, could, possibly, rationalization. So I do this in order to preserve my head, because otherwise the reason would be chopped off with this madness. In addition, there's a very interesting problem which has been touched on over and over again, which is the mode depletion problem. That's how the node has started the meeting off. The quantum theoretical mode, certainly in usual field theory, lose their significance when their momenta, the k will be the physical momentum, the quantum theoretical mode lose their significance when the wave number becomes greater than Planckian. The system becomes a strongly coupled system. That mode, that would-be mode, interacts with everything in sight. There are other modes, for example. You can look at the heart, you can take a Newtonian approximation to gravity, and you can look at what the Hartree-Fock interaction energy is. Well, once its k is greater than the Planck mass, its Hartree-Fock interaction energy dominates a zero-point energy. So it doesn't make any sense. Moreover, not only does it interact with other modes, it interacts with everything under the sun, if we believe that's the grainy spectrum, whatever that grainy spectrum might be. It interacts with all of that at the Planckian level. So to contemplate the study of configurations of quantum fields at a length scale which is less than Planckian makes no more sense, this being a strongly interacting system, makes no more sense than to contemplate the configuration of a liquid, of a fluid, which is a liquid, a dense liquid, in terms of the momentum of the independent components of the molecules which make up that liquid. They hit each other so often that their survival in a momentum state is a negligible quantity, and one must study a liquid in terms of strongly interacting configurations. And the nature of the vacuum at the Planckian and trans-Planckian level cannot be considered in the sense of a configuration that you can elaborate from three modes any more than you can consider the vacuum of the liquid to be composed of independent momenta of molecules, nor the vacuum of QCD at a long length scale that can be interpreted in terms of the free momentum modes. So, It's a completely different physics that we have to head for. And Raphael Sorkin had an inspiration, probably based to some extent on the old inspirations of Wheeler and of Hawking, called space-time foam, an underlying grainy structure, perhaps made of objects which are black holes in character. And using this inspiration, he was one of, he and his colleagues were among the rare people who took it out of that idea, out of the realm of words, and should like to try to do something quantitative with it. So this is called the closed-set scenario for the generation of dark energy in the adiabatic era. I shall give a somewhat modified version of it, not too different from the way it's presented, but the words maybe differ a little. Here we are, an observer. We are influenced by what's in the backward light on of us. This drawing makes sense. We're in the adiabatic era, so we know what we're talking about. The expansion is very, very slow on the Planckian level. Expanding space. The space is expanding here, adiabatically it's very slow, nevertheless expanding, is delivered in lumps, Planckian lumps. These lumps are laid down sequentially. So it's a set because it's a set of lumps, and it's a corset because the lumps are laid down sequentially. So what happens here is caused by events on the lumps which are in the backward light cone over there. And there was a nice point. What happens here is caused by the events that happen on lumps laid down in the backward light cone over there. So each observer sees his cross-set. What are the events that happen on a cross-set? And now I quote the words, they're not defined in the paper. The words are that a cross-set in the adiabatic era exchanges vacuum energy. I put it between quotation marks. So it's up to us to decide what those words mean. With a space that has been laid down, it's up to us to find, you know what we mean by space, that has been laid down in the past light cone. And I add, laid down, I suppose, in the Planckian region that surrounds it. The size of each lump is Planckian. The mean density is Planckian. Everything is Planckian. There's nothing in the theory that's not of order one in Planckian units. Yes, there is something in the theory. Because we're in the adiabatic theory, there is the density of radiation and the density of matter, which is very much less than that. There's a very deep, unsaid assumption, which I consider extremely profound. The macroscopic response, the Hubble constant, responds to that vacuum energy. The vacuum energy that the corsets into the space that the corsets give, or the vacuum energy decreases because the corsets take energy in some exchange process, but the vacuum, the macroscopic response, the Hubble constant, the macroscopic Hubble constant of the cosmos is the response to that vacuum energy, and not to the energy of the degrees of freedom which are sequestered in the corset elements. If we consider the corset elements as black holes in character, that's rather natural. They're hidden at horizons. So there must be some kind of exchange process where each corset has sequestered degrees of freedom and a cis-Planckian leakage, a cloud of cis-Planckian material out of the corsets. And there must be some overlap between these leakages, which give rise to what we call vacuum energy in the cis-Planckian sense. So that is the implication of this picture that the stuff that's sequestered in the corset elements does not directly elicit a macroscopic response, but only indirectly due to exchange with the cisplankian vacuum, which cisplankian vacuum has arisen from cisplankian degrees of freedom that hang around the corsets but can leak out enough to give you a cisplankian world. Thus, when I read this paper, I come to the picture that a space is made by corset proliferation. Modes and cisplankian vacuum energy arise concomitantly. If I believe that the modes arise because of the leakage of the cisplankian material about each corset element, then of course I don't have any dilemma with the dilution of modes, because the more the space comes, because I'm supposing that the corset defining a space at Planckian density, as the universe arises, the number of corsets goes up. Each corset contributes to this Planckian material. Therefore, the number of modes rises in proportion to the volume and the mode density stays fixed. And I lose the problem. That becomes a secondary problem to the far more profound problem. Why do the corsets come in the first place? So the problem of mode proliferation is replaced by the problem of a space proliferation. But space proliferation is a little easier to conceive because we have an energy constraint. If we have this homogeneous medium and we propose that macroscopic reasoning is applicable, then the equation h squared rho applied to the bulk of this homogeneous region makes sense. So once we say that there's a homogeneous region, then because the rho that we're contemplating exists, that is going to expand. So it's easier to conceive of space proliferation than it is to conceive of a mode proliferation. And if we contemplate space proliferation happening by lumps, by steps, by discrete steps, then we may have made some conceptual progress. I told you everything will be in the condition. Now, is it useful? For the moment, it's worse. Well, yes, it is useful. Otherwise, I wouldn't bother to talk about it. The first estimate, just a shot, of the magnitude of dark energy so obtained in the adiabatic era. It's very easy to come by. If n of t is the number of corset elements in the space-time volume of my backward light cone, the v of t being its volume, then because the density is 1, I'm always in Planckian units, then, and v of t you can easily calculate because we can use classical concepts with now in general relativity, if we know the Hubble constant, it's very easy to calculate the volume of the backward light cone. And since there's only one parameter in this business, it's obvious there has to be a sum number times h times the Hubble constant to the power minus 4 at time pi. Then, and each element in that volume is exchanging energy with the vacuum. But then the net variation of energy is a random process, and hence it's a plus or minus the square root of the number of elements in the backward light cone, the density divided by the volume of the light cone. N is equal to V, so the square root is H minus 2 or H minus 4. So the fluctuation of the vacuum energy, which you come by with no work whatever, is proportional to the square of the Hubble constant when the observation is made. And if we suppose that the total density has matter and these fluctuations of vacuum energy, then the dark energy and the matter energy are inevitably of the same order of magnitude.
How should we interpret that fluctuation? Is it that tomorrow it might have the same value, only negative?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or somewhere else in
space? We'll end up with it.
Maybe.
So, but we'll throw it out.
Maybe not tomorrow, but after one double time.
We're going, if it goes to negative, there are runs that it does not go, and when the total energy it goes negative, but they throw it out. Because they don't consider it. The statement is, I haven't shown you the stochastic model. But they have a stochastic model in which there are runs, and I'll show that. But show you the model that will be essential to the talk. And in my opinion, what happens is when the total energy goes to zero, you throw out the model of fluctuating energy due to the exchange with the cross set, because there isn't any energy for the cross set to take out. It can only go in. And I'm going to use this thought to make it inflation out of this constant. And the inflating mass density is not plus or minus the square root of n over n, but it will be n over n. And that's why the inflational energy density is of order 1, as against 1 over square root of n, which is 8 squared. So in the adiabatic era. And when you run into the trouble that the total energy density of the adiabatic era is equal, it goes negative, I would prefer just to say that your model has gone screwy. You have to have a fluctuation that's sensible. And if it's not sensible, we'll do something else.
But what I don't understand is that the time length scale for this stochastic process that controls this process must be the Planck time and Planck length. So when you average over many, many Planck volumes,
it's zero.
Now, averaged over a
averaged over the adiabatic era, they've gone to, in the stochastic process, which I write down, and they've gone to 10 orders of magnitude in the scale factor, and they've gone down to 10 orders of magnitude.
We're averaging over this room here.
I think that there's a good answer for that. If you look at the past life cone of this point over here and then the past life cone of the point over where you are, they're almost covering all the same points in the past. So we do have different fluctuations that we see at our locations, but largely the fluctuations that are added up are the same. So maybe there is a reason for it to vary slowly. It's intrinsically fluctuating at one point, but it wouldn't change necessarily that rapidly.
Before,
what comes out to be the typical time scale for the fluctuations then? Or how long do we have to average
to get a very different fluctuation?
They have
probably so our past life cones are very different. So
but they have a. Robert said. Yeah. And they have they take a time slice, and they have that when A varies by a factor of 10. They may have, in their stochastic processes, 20 time slices with an Ni, a macroscopic number of Ni in each of these time slices. So that gives you the order of magnitude of the kind of histograms that they take into account. Before I describe the result, just to whet your appetite, just to show what they get out. This is in this plot here. This is the energy density. The log of the energy density is a function of log A, where A is spanning here at 10 orders of magnitude and on one of their runs. And the bottom line here is if it goes from the radiator to the matter-dominated universe, and this is the amount of a fluctuation of the vacuum energy that it here is quite close to within an order of magnitude of these runs. That is the value of one of the runs. It's not claiming that they are explaining anything. They want to see if it's possible to get from this picture, if it's possible in this random exchange, that you can get some likelihood of having the universe that we see. That's the object. And not to explain it, but to see if they can get some idea. That's.
Do they want to explain the acceleration that we observe with this vacuum energy?
And this vacuum energy will give you an acceleration because lambda, there's a d lambda dt, lambda is changing. So there's going to be a d lambda dt. And then as Ted mentioned yesterday, when you have a d lambda dt, then you have to give up a relativity, general relativity in the acceleration equation. Or you can invent a source of pressure in the acceleration equation, which contains lambda dot.
But that amounts to inventing the
acceleration. That's an invention. Okay. That's not explaining. Okay. The only thing that they do is to, it's an invention. But the only thing that's, yes, I didn't say. And the matter and the radiation being subject to their separate energy conversions will go like 1 over a cubed and 1 over a fourth respectively. That's an input.
Okay. But you also, in order to get the acceleration, you need the vacuum energy not to redshift. So this is really
they say that
a necessary curve, condition to obtain acceleration.
They say that that curve, and I'm not an expert, I take the word for it. Is consistent with phenomenology. I'm sorry that I'm not sufficiently expert on the phenomenology. Now, if I want,
there are two issues involved in cosmological points of time. One is the point, as you pointed out at the beginning, was the quantum field theory problem. If you do a quantum field theory, you calculate the vacuum energy, it's quantity divergent. So you get this ridiculous number, 10 to 100.
Let's assume that that's so.
So
it's assumed that
you don't solve that problem.
Yeah. Thank you, John. It's assumed, in order to make this go through, the way they say, that when rho m goes to zero, and rho radiation goes to zero, because A becomes so large, that rho lambda goes to zero. So assume that you end up with a quiescent, non-expanding universe of zero total energy density on the classical level. I prefer to replace those words by saying it is assumed that you go towards the end of the adiabatic era to a metastable state where the quantum field is still fluctuating, where the rho lambda is going to be small, namely, there's going to be compensatory effects between zero-point energy and gravitational attractions, which is a consistent assumption, I say, because if the universe were expanding, it would make energy, because it would be a temporally varying metric. So then it would be inconsistent to say that you will have a universe expanding, and it is empty because it gets filled. But at least there's an element of consistency that there are compensatory effects between gravity and the zero-point effects, which is a non-expanding state on the average, but which is only metastable because of a constant fluctuation, which you build up and you get another one of these homogeneous patches. And oops. So that's my understanding.
If there was a symmetry, which we often keep looking for, if there is a symmetry which we keep looking for that cancels the quantum divergence with zero-point vacuum energy, then there's no vacuum energy to gravitate.
For example, if you looked at the Newtonian, of gravity, and you worked out the Hartree-Fock approximation, just as a stupid example. So the total amount of energy in the modes, because the modes are interacting as you would do in a many body system, then you can tune the number times the Planck mass to put the sum of those equal to zero.
So how does this solve the quantum field theory problem?
But that's not solving it. I'm saying that just illustrating an example.
So you're just assuming that somehow it is solved.
Right. I'm not solving the I'm saying that I can see that it's something that is solvable.
It's a horrible problem. It's hopefully.
If there was ever an understatement, a euphemism.
So the famous physicist wants to do this.
It's an impossibly difficult problem.
You don't want to be a talking person.
No. It becomes solvable. What we do is assume some things and try to see, given these assumptions, if we can correlate together other things. Now, I want to give you a little picture which is going to help me in my discourse about how I conceive. Well, because we get a row, lambda, a fluctuating row lambda, seemingly of the order of magnitude, let's start to try to conceive of what is going on. So let's go to the theory of metals and see analogous physical processes which are very familiar to everybody. Consider the tight binding approximation of a metal. What do you do? You have an isolated atom, here it is. It's composed of 4 electrons and valence electrons outside the electrons. You put a bunch of sodium atoms in a box. What will happen? They'll attract each other. They'll go to an optimal density, which minimizes the energy. And you're going to have a core here, a core here, a core here. And the valence electrons will overlap. And when the valence electrons overlap, you have to go to eigenstates. So you have the same field-theoretic material. They're sometimes localized, called core electrons, and sometimes their leakage is out of the cores, which then have to be gone into linear combinations. If it's a translationally homogeneous medium, you classify the eigenstates according to the momentum. So you have the same type of material in corsets and modes. So the modes come about from the cis-Rankine leakages that come out of the corsets. And you're at the minimization of energy. So if you have a total number of corsets n, then you go to an optimal density. So there's going to be an optimal density of modes. And these modes are going to be stabilized into an energy ground state, I suppose. And that is our picture of a quiescent vacuum. That's fluctuating all the time. And you have quite an important bonus, if you think about it. If you take an alkaline metal like a sodium, then you have two kinds of excitation, one of which is not important to us. It's two kinds of connected excitation. One of which is not important to us, which is the platform, which is the business of charge, because it has electric charge. And so that is not the relevant excitation. But what the relevant excitation is that you have compressional modes. You have a compression and the dilatation of the density. And namely, in the cosmological problem, you would have fluctuations of the cutoff, fluctuations of where the mode concept begins to stop and the corsets begin to get. And you can have these compressional modes. Now, what happens in sodium is when you compute the velocity of sound, the velocity of sound is the bulk modulus of the electrons in the bands, in the modes. The cores don't touch in usual sound in sodium. You have to push very hard to get the cores. So it's the bulk modulus, the macroscopic response. The macroscopic response of the system, like the Hubble constant, as I said, is due to the material in modes, not the material in the process. The modes are too hidden to be macroscopically responding. Now, you learn then some rationalization about how it is that you make the assumption that it is the macroscopic response is due to degrees of freedom which are delocalized, and not the degrees of freedom which are localized. I'm going to go into this in a little more detail, in fact, in a lot more detail, when I go into the way I conceive of the destiny of this of these compressional modes, when I go into the inflationary epoch. For the moment, I just mentioned that to help you try to think about what might be the fundamental mechanisms which one could entertain. Once more, there's always this conditional. Here is the stochastic process in detail for which I want to present. Rho lambda can be considered an action density. So this is the action density in the I plus one slice as it changes from the R slice to the I plus one slice because of the exchanges of energy to the vacuum in the way I defined it due to delta Ni coset elements in the I slice. To calculate the Ni and the delta, calculate these Ni's and delta Ni's, we have to use the energy constraint to get the volume in the I slice. Remember that the volume goes like 1 over h to the 4. So knowing the output of here, you have these coupled equations between the volume and the energy density in the I slice. This thing did by machines. To have success, they have to introduce a dimensionless parameter in their stochastic process, which for me will be vital. It's this parameter alpha. And in this picture I showed you of Rho, they say that they can make realistic contact with reality for some runs if alpha is between 10 to the minus 2 and 10 to the minus 1.
Are you going to say what alpha? Why do they have to introduce alpha?
If alpha goes too small, then you don't get enough dark energy. If alpha gets too big, it messes up the nucleus synthesis in the range array which they treat.
But what does alpha correspond to in the fluctuating coset?
So alpha, some. Okay, want to take my punch line away?
I don't know. You'll answer it later?
Yeah.
But for them, what does it
give me 2.5 minutes.
Okay. Will you tell us what the slicing, or what determines the slicing?
What determines?
The slicing. This is a discrete stochastic process, so you have to determine
the limit of their machines they take.
No, but physically, in the physical picture, does the result depend on the slicing?
I don't know. I had hoped that Raphael would be here, because I didn't make these calculations. All I have is this paper, and so I don't know that.
Because that's the answer to my previous question. That is the time scale, in this case, replaced by the speed process, which determines the stochastic process. But it should be Planck distant slices in a microscopic picture.
It's a shame.
I don't think that this is what they've done.
It's a shame Raphael isn't here to go. He wasn't well, because I wanted to pump him to these details, because I don't know. But I will when I see him shortly. So as I say, the end point of this stochastic process, for those which are accepted, when the total energy density does not get less than zero, it will be that if the total energy density goes to zero, a quiescent universe, and you go to nothing. It's much ado about nothing, full of sound and fury, it's signified nothing. And that's unfortunately the theological state of spirit. And if Freeman Dyson would explode, of course he hates that. And my belief is that you go to a meta-state with a new universe emerging, and that on these exchanges, if ever the energy density gets too low, there are mechanisms which we don't understand, which force the coast sets only to pick it up because they simply cannot take the energy in, but the exchange process still is going on, so that they can only give. And that incites me to go into inflation. So as I say, my picture of space-time then is that there's a low density that is above, which is in equilibrium with the process. And in the metal, this leads to acoustic fluctuations. Namely, if you make an imbalance and you put too many modes here, then the number of modes in sodium will go down there. And so you get an acoustic fluctuation, which is the speed of sound of sodium. I'm going to make this into an inflaton. I say that an inflaton is due to the fluctuation of the mode density. However, unlike sodium, the number of modes is not a conserved quantity. The number of electrons in the valence band is not conserved. The modes can be produced or made as sources and sinks of modes. So if I have a corset element, it can leak its cis Planckian material into the system of modes and increase the energy by the amount of energy that the corset delivers to the mode space per exchange. So I can have an equilibrium situation, and then the corset gives out a cis Planckian degree of freedom, and then it will have an energy which will oscillate without much more energy which has been given in or taken out. And therefore, there's a mass mu which corresponds to the amount of energy which is given or taken from the vacuum by these exchangers. Now, so we're going to get, in addition to the acoustic mode, and by the definition of the speed of light, and the speed of light of all fields is the same, because I imagine that this inflaton is a collective mode of all fields, and so all of these fields propagate with the same velocity. So there's a common speed of light to all fields in my vision, and this will be, if I didn't have the exchange, and then I have a mass due to the exchange with the cross-sets. However, and now we look at the dark energy scenario, and we had this little parameter alpha. And if you noticed, I said that the amount of energy was proportional to the square root of alpha squared delta ni. So alpha squared is the mass that's given. It's plus or minus the square root of alpha squared delta ni. So alpha squared is the mass. And the this creature is going to oscillate with a frequency in Planckian units, which is alpha squared. And the good alpha squared vary between 10 to the minus 1 and 10 to the minus 2. Well, if you get a mu squared, if you get a mu, which is 10 to the minus 4, then you shouldn't feel very badly. I mean, it's not a disgrace, because given the type of approximations and given the homogeneous stochastic process that we're talking about, and all the other approximations, to have some notion of how you can get an inflaton and how you can get it to oscillate due to a mass by appealing to dark energy, to my mind, promotes you to feeling that there is some chance that you're not doing complete nonsense.
And earlier on, you said, are you imagining there's no inflaton potential other than the master?
Oh, I put mu squared. Yeah, I mean, in this case, it would be like that. It would be mu squared, phi squared. But now, if you be careful, because if I suppose that the inflationary epoch is in a condensed phase, with a value of 5C, then that parameter could change because I'm experimenting about a local equilibrium where phi is equal to 5C and not around phi is equal to 0.
Does your interpretation or proposed interpretation of what the inflaton is suggest in any way that there should be a vacuum expectation value of
no.
phi? You're just putting that in by hand.
I'm sorry. But if you don't think that makes me suffer, I really can't. I can't justify a condensed phase. Does anybody know why? What forces condensation? However, the energy constraint, if the universe is expanding and you have an inflaton field and it's homogeneous, minus h squared is equal to an inflaton energy, and it's homogeneous, how are you being pushed, in a sense, to a classical energy? Because it's homogeneous and not like that. So the very fact of a cosmological inflationary expansion is the negative energy of the gravitation of the field due to the expansion, which is minus h squared, not in some sense applying you with an effective field, which is stabilizing a non-trivial condensation. But then why is its amplitude equal to what it is? Why is phi equal to 1 or 10? But there is something lurking which is sensible, not seasonal. Now, what I will argue, however, is whereas rho lambda is infinitesimal, in the adiabatic era, it's perfectly natural on my picture that rho lambda in inflation should be 1, because the reason why the energy density is the square root of n over n in the adiabatic era, plus or minus square root of n over n in the adiabatic era, is in the adiabatic era, the universe is expanding very slowly. So there's time to give and take, since Planckian degrees of freedom to the process. However, in inflation, the rate of inflation is precisely the same order of magnitude as the rate of exchange. So you put the energy in, it goes, it keeps on going. The faster the energy goes in, the faster it will dilate. So you don't have time to suck it back. So my hope would be that if...
So which parameter controls fast versus slow? Is this h over m Planck? Or are you saying that because inflation took place at a higher energy scale?
Mu is the amount of energy delivered to the exchange. And the rate of expansion is mu times the amplitude of the inflaton. Mu squared, mu phi is h. And I suppose that phi is of order 1 because the natural fluctuations are of order 1 on the scale I have, but I can't do better than that. So I would say, in any case, that h squared is like the exchange.
But what is the important part? Is it important that inflation produces a nearly acidic-like phase, or is it important that inflation takes place at a high energy scale?
My answer to that, can I reasonably condense it, and I say no, but not completely no, because that one supports the other, that the condense supports the expansion, and the expansion carrying negative energy minus h squared supports the idea of the condense. That they support one another. If I didn't have the expansion and minus h squared of an energy, I don't see why there should be any classical energy. If I didn't have any classical energy, I don't see why there should be any expansion, any inflation.
So we are now entering another inflationary era. Would this picture still work? Where, I mean, with the dark, if dark energy is the cosmological constant, a couple of
For the moment, we're fluctuating, and you have to assume that there's enough energy to keep it going the way it is until the amplitude of these fluctuations becomes impossibly small, and you it's very likely that you go to zero energy density, and then probably a new homogeneous sheet will start.
I can't help but say at this point that one of the major problems of this whole accelerating universe is that it's happening now. It goes from zero redshift to zero to about 4.7. It's called the coincidence problem.
The coincidence problem.
Yeah, so why is it happening now? It's highly magical.
Well, what they like,
turns on the fluctuation.
What these people, you mean why now? Yeah. What they like is now is always. At any time you will have dark energy comparable to zero lambda.
No, but before.
Everlasting lambda.
Before a ratio to 1.7, the data appeared to show the universe was decelerating, slowing down. So the universe is slowing down, and all of a sudden, for some preposterous reason,
Oh, you mean why does the sheet get formed now?
Why does the acceleration happen now?
John, this is 1.8 billion years from now.
We have the
lambda is a stochastic variable at late times. And so what the data is telling us that between a redshift of 1 and 0, we are in a region of a stochastic process where lambda is large compared to order of order 1. And between a redshift of 2 and 1, it will be less. Between a redshift of 3 and 2, it will be large again.
Yes.
So the coincidence problem is solved.
But that's what the coincidence, right? I didn't know the expression.
What about a redshift of 10 to the 6?
It's oscillating. Omega lambda is a stochastic process that over a huge range of redshifts has an amplitude 1.
The universe is accelerating all the time.
Every second Hubble time, it's accelerating. Every second Hubble time, it's not accelerating.
But how can you make any predictions about acceleration or deceleration if you don't have energy conservation? I don't understand this.
Equations give you a stochastic. It gives you the probability. The equations are complete. It gives you the expectation value of rho lambda at any time pi. You have to ask when you do the stochastic processes. Are there parameters alpha which are permissible in that they are consistent with phenomenology?
So that amounts to saying that our universe is one realization of the stochastic process, and there's nothing more that we can learn about it.
Well,
and
unless
so
you
happens
believe,
that we accelerate.
Unless you believe what I did, that stochastic process is nourished with a parameter which is related to the amplitude.
Disruptive, but there must be a parameter. Are you telling me that this data predicts that I have inflation near the Planck mass, and then I have inflation now, some 14 billion years later? It tells exactly what happens now.
At late times,
some fine tuning.
Well, you see, I'm not Raphael, so I can really not completely defend.
No, I talked to him about this, and he says he doesn't solve the coincidence problem. I've actually talked to him about this. It's one of my first questions.
Well, but by coincidence problem, you mean that today, as opposed to redshift 2, we are accelerating?
Well, as opposed to a redshift 10 to the 6.
The way that I understand this work is that omega lambda of the order oscillating about 1 is an attractive late-time fixed point.
Yeah, but he said to me that there is a parameter in there that determines the amplitude of oscillation.
Yes, the amplitude of oscillation does not give up.
To get the right.
But you have to pick the good stochastic processes to get the right.
To get the right answer.
You can get wrong universes.
You still have a constant problem.
You have to ask in the stochastic processes that they have considered and they've understood that they have considered, what is the probability that some of them work and they duplicate what we see? And the answer, with its alpha between 0.1 and 0.2, that probability is finite, between 0.01 and 0.02.
Can I maybe say something with respect to your comment about energy? So you see, I'm always thinking about our back reaction approach, where we claim that omega lambda of the order 1 is an attractive fixed point as well. What happens there is that there's an energy exchange between the effect of cosmological background and the fluctuations. So if you just focus on the zero mode, then you don't have covariant energy conservation. If you focus on the fluctuations themselves, the covariant energy conservation is valid too. But if you sum of the two, then you have covariant energy conservation. And just a side remark, if you look at linear stochastic inflation, that does not have, that violates covariant energy conservation. And so maybe what you're saying is that you have energy interplay between this C and the classical background. So if you just focus on the C itself, there'll be some energy leaking out. It's it going into the background. So individually, energy looks like it's not conserved, but the total energy is conserved.
Yes, all I'm saying is that in order to predict.
I would like to understand your back reaction calculations, if there's any correspondence between that in the exchange with the cosmic fluctuation.
Yeah, I think it's
fine. I would like to understand that. It's very important.
In order to get the acceleration of the universe we observe today, you need not only omega lambda, you also need the equation of state. And so, of course, you can feed in as much in this, not in the back reaction panel, but in this model, you can feed in energy at some prescribed.
You're right. And that's Ted would insist that the proof of the pudding is if you can make it inhomogeneous and make progress. And that certainly has not been done at all.
So in this approach, the equation of state of this thing that's oscillating is that of the cosmological principle. You don't have to put that in, that's automatic.
It is only a cosmological constant that accelerates it. Okay. Energy conservation is assumed or is valid as we know it. Otherwise, it doesn't accelerate. This is the point. You see, all of these cosmological observations hang together so nicely,
right.
Only using standard energy conservation. Once we drop that, I think we have to relook at each other.
I don't know why you say standard energy conservation when you have dark energy. If anything could be less standard, that certainly is. We don't have any idea what it is.
It's perfectly standard, it's just a different equation of state.
Come on. When you have a cosmological constant which is 10 to the 100 times bigger than the dark energy, vacuum energy that you're proposing now, I get to call that standard is slightly exaggerating the definition of the word standard.
Back to the point of your theory. Problem.
No, you have to make some rationale.
I'm not saying that we understand what it is.
I want to point out the profound analogy between a creation of quanta in the black hole evaporation. And I made a comment on one of the talks about that the Trans-Planckian problem far transcends inflation, that there's all kinds of interesting things in physics which happen here and now. For example, of a black hole evaporation. That can happen anywhere, at any time. And there must be all kinds of processes. We're constantly confronted with the Trans-Planckian problem. So we're constantly confronted, I am constantly confronted with the notion of the corset, because that is one way to confront the Trans-Planckian problem. Now, when you do Hawking radiation, this is an editing Finkelstein sketch, this is R is equal to zero, this is the singularity, A Hawking photon, this is the horizon of a black hole. This is a star falling in. And the horizon, because of energy conservation, in a classical equation, shrinks. It fluctuates. This is a mean. So it shrinks in this fluctuating way. It shrinks. It makes, we're here. It makes the space available to us increase. As the classical energy constraint equation of cosmology makes space available to degrees of freedom, cis-Planckian degrees of freedom, increase. But the mechanisms are highly analogous. You have a fluctuating thing, but there is a classical content to it, which you write down, of macroscopic character. Similarly for the black hole. Here, it is proposed that space increases. You increase the number of process. Here, as the amount of available space increases, you confront the trans-Planckian problem, which is present in the Hawking evaporation problem, by saying it has increased enough to admit a coset. From that coset, you can make modes. You put a coset in, it has its cis-Planckian leakage. In the prior history, the space here has been filled with a coset. So there's an overlap of the cis-Planckian leakage with the mode space here. It incorporates, remember we spoke about this yesterday, there's a process in which the whole thing gets incorporated in. And somewhere around here, the Hawking mode analysis it takes over, but you do the value of transformation, etc., and you get the usual Planckian physics out of Hawking. The point I want to make is that you have, in both cases, this smooth classical description. Both begin with a chaos. You can throw tomato cans into the origin at random, and you accumulate mass. If there's an old hair theorem after a while, it takes over. The metric becomes smooth. There's a classical description of what happens. Evaporation ensues by making quanta. Similarly, I think inflation begins from this random initial mess. Some smoothing out process occurs in some localized region of a manifold. There is a smooth description, a smooth classical description, which then gets converted into making first cosets from the cosets, modes from the modes of quanta by the reheating process. Here the same. Smoothed out process, a classical energy response, making cosets, making modes, making quanta. The processes are very, very similar. So, as I say, everything is in the conditional. We hardly know what we're talking about. We hardly know the definition of words. I have used the word manifold. I would have liked to use the word space. I cannot use the word space. What means space? If we have this trans-Planckian problem, and we say that the configuration of fields, which we usually use in terms of mode configurations, are not applicable, we can't make a microscope. We can't look into it. We don't know what space means. And as I just was speaking with Lenore years ago, Lenore said, and after that Alan Cohn as well, and I wish I understood these things better, and maybe Lenore will be a little more explicit. Really, there's only spectral content to things. For example, in time, because we have the energy constraint, but there we can make a little progress. Because what time for example, when you have a virtual quantum mechanical process, and virtually you give up the conservation of energy, but you know that energy is absolutely conserved in virtue of time current, the time reparametrization invariance. We know that energy is conserved, so we cannot give up the conservation of energy. So where does it go? It goes in the recoil of the gravitational field, which is coupled to that system. And that you can make quantitative, and you can root into, and you can produce a matrix element which oscillates with the gravitational recoil energy. And that is where time comes from. It would be beautiful if we can execute this kind of analysis and say that because momentum is conserved, total momentum is conserved by constraint, that space arises because when particles scatter each other and there's an exchange and somehow there's a vagary in local momentum conservation, because we cannot do it exactly because space is.
Could you do it in 1 plus 1 dimension?
Could you do it?
Could you do it in 2 dimensions?
And let's do it. So that I think is the key to so much, to understanding what we mean by the word space when we cannot measure space. Space is a vulgar word. The word is spectra. The word is spectra. The limitations that the spectra give us and the possibility give us.
Robert, so, I mean, do you want a reaction to that? It seems just completely to run counter to your previous remarks about the role of process and understanding what it means for space to grow. I mean, you seemed very comfortable a few moments ago thinking about some discrete nodules of space coming into existence.
But did I say that in the process there was space? I said there was some manifold. I don't know what it means. I know that there is a gravitational field complex.
The number of points in the concept you identified with the space-time volume, so yes. It sort of follows that each concept element occupies one Planck unit of spatial volume.
Yeah.
No?
Yeah. But what does it mean to me to say it's like this, and you say I have space-time volume when I have to include the space in the process? When I don't have modes about which I make, with a little bit of space which I use, but to find out what I'm talking about. So my words were too imprecise. That's why I say it's a vulgar word. But I think that the way physics will go, honestly, is bit by bit, we're going to drop the vocabulary of space in the usual sense and talk about a mean space somehow, but not space as we think of it. I think we can only think in terms of momenta. And, yeah, only in terms of the configurations in the manifold, which probably can be phrased in a spectral way, but I don't know. So, to conclude, our ignorance is such that everybody is invited, that our spirits roam fancy free, ye gods that reign, tell us how the world can be. And with this experience, that's all.
Does this do these stochastic runs of the everlasting lambda make any predictions for how tomorrow will be? I mean, can we be in anti-discipline tomorrow?
And you have to extrapolate from that.
But this one successful run that they had, how does this? Does it make any predictions for the next tunnel time?
The prediction is always that Roland is going to be the owner of Roland.
On the mean?
Of the order, the plus or minus Roland, yeah. That's the only prediction. And it can go negative, and then, as I say, when that happens, then the model is wrong. You shouldn't be able to allow the road top to go negative.
Well, no, but I thought it's not that they would say the model is wrong. It's some sort of atrophic principle that would say we consider only those.
I don't like to say it's an anthropic principle. I like to say that you're showing that the universe that we live in is a possible outcome of this process. If you say that that's the anthropic principle, yes. But I think philosophically, that's not. The anthropic principle is often said that. You know, the universe is there and what it is because we are part of it. No, I'm saying it's not that. It's not that our universe is a possible outcome of this process. And not that we're part of it, but it's a possible outcome and that's it.
The anthropic principle says that I don't know how to get the right answer, but there must be one.
Must be somewhere.
This is an empty state.
Well, that's anthropic. To say that there must be one is anthropic.
That's a
I don't say that there must be one. I'm saying that it's possible that we are the universe, so that means that we realize that possibility. It's not the same thing. It's not saying that there must be one.